A cry that just choked away as she stared at the instrument panel. Rex could see it too from his gunnery station. The hornet's nest, the savage nest, had awoken. A solid mass of hostile targets were in pursuit now. Savage marines of every size and type, big hulking fighters, what looked like mechs, just about everything the savvies had, and all coming right after them. From the troop compartment, Rex could feel the eyes of the two little girls watching him. He'd heard it said that children saw and heard everything. They always did. And they understood far more than adults ever gave them credit for. Chapter 63. The bread truck, loaded down with liberated captives, hadn't quite made it to the lift that would take them down through the various levels of Old Colony's outer complex before it gave out again, the result of constant savage attacks. Martin and Greenhill had managed to put the attackers down, but not before the tires and engine compartment were ruined. "Everybody off the truck," Sergeant Major Andres ordered. He pulled the survivors off the smoking vehicle and hustled them forward down the big tunnel they'd been traversing. More savages appeared, dismounting from the back of a civilian pickup truck and firing on the stationary bread truck moments after the last of the former prisoners had jumped off. Greenhill and Martin laid down a base of interlocking fire from both sides of the tunnel, and despite the poor physical condition of the refugees, they moved with haste. Bullets skipped up into the path of a straggling clump of survivors, narrowly missing Greenhill.
"Martin, time to drop back."
He ran to an alcove, turned, and set up a steady stream of pulse fire with his heavy assault rifle, while Martin in turn fell back. The rest of the team moved forward, trying to outrun the din of blaster fire that seemed to haunt their steps. A din that grew louder as Martin and Greenhill added their own steady pulse fire into the pursuing elements. As soon as they had all reached the lift, a disc the size of a carrier's bridge, Andres activated it. Everyone with a blaster rifle fired until the large doors shut behind them and the lift began to descend.
"They must have used this to move heavy construction equipment and bulk cargo down into the lower tunnels," announced McAfee, still panting from the running firefight.
But no one else cared what the government had used it for before the entire world was ruined by the savage invasion. They only cared about surviving.
And the only hope any of them had was the high-speed rail that might take them back to the LZ, if they could reach it in time. The Chang was due back in less than 3 hours.
The disc moved slowly, groaning mechanically and occasionally echoing out with loud titanic booms, as locks at various levels slipped in and out of place. The survivors huddled along one edge of the disc while Martin, Greenhill, and the sergeant major scanned the darkness of the abandoned levels they passed through, watching for more savages to come at them in some fresh new assault. Time and charge packs were running out. They'd lost 3 survivors in the running fight to reach the disc, people who'd been hit and bled out alone because there was no time for the soldiers to give them aid, and no way to carry them along. The other ragged and dirty survivors, those without weapons and nothing else to do, had tried to help them, but to no avail. In 2 cases, the wounds didn't even seem all that bad, didn't seem like they should have been fatal, but they were. Like maybe those poor souls had simply been through too much already over the last 6 weeks. Their time in the galaxy was done. At the bottom of the well, they arrived into a vast underground domed vault, from which several tunnels, guarded by impressive vault doors 2 and 3 stories high, led off in different directions.
"Last stop," announced Andres and ordered everyone off the lift.
"Should be that way, guys,"
said McAfee. He was using a battle board on which Davis had sketched a rudimentary map, and so far her sketches were proving more or less accurate.
"No kidding," said Greenhill.
He pointed up at an overhead sign, showing the way to the transit tunnel trains. McAfee put the board away.
"Well, we didn't know those signs would be there, man."
That was when the Morlocks announced their presence once more. They couldn't yet be seen, but their howls warbled and whooped out across the dark caverns. Andres cursed the all-too-familiar sound and attempted to hush the screaming survivors.
"Not so loud," the sergeant major called out. "Damn it, be quiet."
At his urging, the panicked survivors hustled forward and bunched up to get onto the frozen escalator.
"Moving up,"
said Martin. He bounded down the escalator, pushing through the survivors.
"They sound like they're still a ways off yet," maybe not even on this level.
Greenhill, Andres called out. You stay back with me. Don't want nothing sneaking up on us. Caffey, keep with the locals.
McAfee was being used as a sort of ad hoc military-civilian interface liaison. Listening to their grievances, agreeing with them, and then at the same time trying to explain why the military did the things it did the way that it did them, which, it seemed, he usually didn't agree with. And then explaining to them the mysteries of the cosmos and how it could be understood by looking through the fourth eye of the mind, but only when you unlock the potentiality of spiritual vision hidden inside us all, man.
All of a sudden, bright government lighting, dull and soulless, filled the terminal. The power had come back on. The escalator lurched to life, jostling the already panicked survivors. Some screamed, others cried or moaned. A few fell and were in danger of being trampled in the rush to get away to any place other than the one they had come from. And yet no place seemed safe anymore. Martin, out of sight below, opened fire.
Contact! Get down!
Shouted the sergeant major at the civilians. Get your heads down and stay down until I tell you otherwise. The sergeant major moved through the huddled press as best he could to reach the bottom of the long escalator. Citizens crouched and cowered around him. Greenhill was left to cover the rear on his own. And now the sound of the big cav sergeant's heavy fire echoed out over the transportation hub too, sounding harsh and brutal to the ears. Enemies up front and in the rear.
Surrounded.
On the subway platform below, the savage Morlocks had made the mistake of charging across open ground with no cover, likely enticed by the screams of the prisoners. They'd entered the area from another platform across the tracks, and Martin, covering behind a directory board that now read "error" for every point in the line and "delayed" for every time, cut down three before they even left the platform, catching them in a sweep of burst fire, then dropped four more as they crossed the wide canyon of the tracks. But five made it far enough to get cover as they disappeared below platform level.
If they're smart, Martin thought as he went to pull a frag off his carrying system, they'll stay down there, hold their automatic slug-throwing rifles over the lip of the platform and just pray and spray.
But he'd seen before that these hunters had traded smarts for bloodthirsty aggression, and the constant noise of pulse fire and frantic survivors was whipping them into a frenzy. The sergeant major raced forward, blazing away with his weapon until he was literally at the edge of the platform, shooting down into the savage hunters. He'd rushed them, and they hadn't expected that. After 6 weeks of being the new alpha predator on New Vega, they were used to being the hunter and not the hunted. Martin cooked the spool on the grenade and yelled, "Frag out! Hit the deck, Sergeant Major." Andres jumped back as the grenade bounced onto the tracks and went off a second later. Any savages that had survived his shooting spree were now a bloody mess, and Martin came forward and made good and sure of it. But up above, Greenhill was firing in longer bursts.
"No rail car, Sergeant Major," said Specialist Martin matter-of-factly.
Andres was bent over, catching his breath. He waved at Martin.
"Get him moving down the tracks on foot. That's all we can do now. I'm going to go back up and help Greenhill."
Soon the bulk of the survivors were moving again, almost running for their lives down the long, dark subway tunnel. But the savage hunters still had the scent, and they would not give up the chase, no matter how many were mowed down by Greenhill and the sergeant major. Martin was ahead, scouting the tunnel and hoping some rail train didn't bear down out of the darkness and slaughter them all. After what seemed at least a kilometer of moving, the sounds of the hunters faded.
"Think they're gone?"
Greenhill asked, taking the opportunity to check his charge packs.
"Shit, I'm almost spent."
"Not much better," Andres looked around. "We definitely moving out of the hillside, though."
"I wonder," he activated his comm. "This is Sergeant Major Andres, Colonel, Tyrus Rex, do you read me?"
He paused and looked to Greenhill. "Not getting a response."
"Let's get going, Sergeant Major."
Andres held up a finger. "One more try."
"This is Sergeant Major Andres, Colonel. Do you read me?"
And then pulse fire erupted from farther down the tunnel. Either the hunters remembered their weapons or savage Marines had joined the hunt.
"Gotta go,"
shouted Greenhill, answering with his pulse rifle.
In case you're still operational, sir, we're proceeding on foot in the government transit tube.
Bullets snapped and hissed around Andres. Close. They were close. The sergeant major ran, catching up to Greenhill, then turned and added his own fire to the mix.
Contact rear,
Greenhill yelled into his comm.
You need me to come back or send Caffey?
Asked Martin.
Negative, growled Andres. Keep that column moving.
Greenhill took a knee to better fire at the sporadic muzzle flashes erupting in the tunnel's distant darkness. Andres sat down right next to him. It was an odd way to set up and fire, and then Greenhill realized that Andres' pulse rifle wasn't firing. He looked over and saw the sergeant major clutching his stomach. His uniform was already dark and wet with blood. Greenhill didn't give aid to the sergeant major. He couldn't. Instead, he kept up a steady stream of covering fire and activated his comm.
Sergeant Major is hit. I need someone back here to pull him back.
I'm on it,
shouted McAfee. He came sprinting back with a few of the more capable survivors to carry the gutshot NCO farther down the tunnel. Martin continued firing, skipping backward as he shot, moving as fast as he could while keeping eyes on the enemy. This was going from bad to worse. And the only way he could see out of it was to try once more to reach the man they'd known as the Colonel, hoping he was still the kind of man who would get them out of there, even if Tyrus Rex was not.
Be advised, any surviving assets on New Vega, we are engaged near the underground subway access at the bottom level of the hilltop subterranean complex. We are on foot with civilian survivors. Sergeant Major Andres is down.
But the specialist got no answer over the static, distorted calm down in the clutching close darkness of that deep tunnel leading off into the unknown. Behind them, the savages were closing in once more.
Colonel, if you're out there, we need help, sir. We're not going to make it.
Chapter 64. They'd lobbed an explosive at the wild man, covering behind his improvised fighting position of ruined savage scout cycles. He'd felt it go over his head in the darkness. That was the last thing he remembered. Remembered that silence between his shots and their return fire. Remembered the sound of the grenade bouncing on the tunnel floor.
How many?
She asked.
20.
He always knew the number. He always knew. Because he knew any number of dead savages made her happy, and so he kept track. Because her happiness meant everything to him. Nothing else in the galaxy really mattered anymore. 20. I killed 20 for you. She was saying what she always said when he felt the grenade go flying over his head in the dark, heard it bounce around. And in that moment, he'd had a choice. Scramble for it and get it away from him, or go ahead and kill one more with the seconds that remained of the sometimes dream and sometimes nightmare of his life. His mind had done the math. A flung grenade had already cooked for at least 3 seconds. Who knew how long the savages ran their fuses, but 5 or 6 was standard for most militaries. Finding it and then getting it away from him with little more than a hurl just to get it down tunnel in the dark. No, 3 seconds wasn't much. And he'd already just burned one on the math, the fatal math. So much of life and death was math, cold, relentless math. Maybe that was why miracles were miracles, because they defied the math. And maybe her voice was its own kind of miracle. After all, it had made a dead man want to live a little longer, if only just for vengeance.
Do another one.
He pulled the trigger one last time.
Babe.
Boom. Lights out, and waiting to feel your flesh torn to shreds by hundreds of pieces of shrapnel or needles like some frags used. And then, maybe, she'd be waiting for him on the other side of whatever. Smiling, glad that he'd finally caught up with them in the place of miracles, holding out their baby for him to dandle on his knee and exchange coos with.
That's not so bad,
he thought as his mind was suddenly scrambled. There was a bang, lights flashed, and it felt like he was going to have a stroke. Or rather, it felt like reality had just stuttered, like the game had frozen or the signal had locked on an image, or the sun had refused to go down. Yeah, that's what it felt like. Reality had just
stuttered, skipped a beat, missed a groove, taken a bad step. He couldn't move and he couldn't see, couldn't hear either. Except he could. He could do all those things. He could do them where he was at now because he was no longer in the tunnel where he'd been shooting down savages. No one shot and gone. It had been a gallery back in the tunnel, a shooting gallery, like the star carnies sometimes set up when they made Planetside and Stendhal. Shoot the ducks, win a prize for your lady, Huss.
Do another one, babe. She'd said that summer night when the stars were close, red hair and that green dress and those eyes.
He was back on their stead now in this place where reality had just stuttered, and he was smiling the biggest dopey grin he could smile. It was so big and dumb, even he could feel it. And here's how it felt. Remember the best day you ever had. The day when everything was perfect and only good times were ever had. And everyone you ever truly loved was there with you, safe and happy, at home. Remember that day when the future seemed like a good thing you weren't always so constantly afraid of. Remember that simple day of good things you took for granted when darkness and evil had not touched you, when the love in your heart had not grown cold. Remember that. That was how he felt at that moment. He could feel how unreasonably happy he was, like every bone in his body was turned to jelly and every pain that had been there, the scars, both real and emotional, those were all just gone now. And it was afternoon turning to evening at the end of a long week. He was finishing up organizing some rope out along the corral in front of their old stead, getting it set up for a horse that he'd need to break come first of the next week. A beautiful horse that half of him wanted to just turn loose and let go to run the plains of Stendhal forever. One of the Mustang stock brought up with the first colonists and let go to run the planet and go where they would. He wanted to let that horse go, but he needed it. So he'd break it. But part of him just wanted to let the beautiful creature go. Later, she came out onto the front porch, and he was struck dumb by how beautiful she was in that moment of every good thing you want to take with you forever. And he had to stop and wonder why she'd ever wanted him, picked him. Don't ask silly questions, an old hand had once told him, because the answers often aren't. The galaxy skipped into that moment, and he was helpless with the joy of vision of her. She was his treasure. Treasure. He'd never known quite how to phrase it, but she was that, his treasure. And all he'd ever been doing since was just killing savages to get back what they'd taken from him. Wasn't that true? That old partner who told him not to ask silly questions said that, leaning one boot up against the fence and watching that Mustang toss her head and throw up dust in the corral, like she knew her wild and free days were over for good. Weren't that true? The old hand asked inside that stuttering reality. He was just a drifter who worked from ranch to ranch, never putting down roots, helping where help was needed. You just wanted your treasure back, didn't you? He nodded that this was true, and when he did, he felt big wet tears fall from his eyes. You never loved her, said the old poke as he uncoiled a lasso and sent it about him right around the big man's chest, as easy a trick as there ever was. You just didn't like having something taken from you. That's all, Hoss. He sat on the ground, smiling like a dope and crying at the same time, watching her on the porch. She was coming out to tell him the chicken was fried and cooling. Dinner soon. That's home to me, he thought, as the cowpoke tightened the lasso around him. He began to crawl across the hard-packed dirt of the yard. If he could just reach the porch, reach her, then he'd be home now. But the old cowpoke was on him, tying him up like a hog. She's just a thing to you, said the old trail hand. He was thin and rangy, and he had a wolf's teeth and eyes. No, no, no.
he was telling the cowboy while smiling, laughing, and crying and crawling all at once. "No," he shouted, "you're a liar. She was my treasure." He couldn't move. He was just feet from her. She stood there on the porch in that dress, smiling her smile.
"You're all done now," said the old poke. "Might as well go ahead and just give up."
He struggled, but even he knew it was useless now. Cowboys tie knots better than a preacher, as the old saying goes. "You're all done now," she said from the porch of their old stead, echoing the poke who'd trussed him up. Sadness washed over him, and then darkness, as he felt himself carried along the tunnel, blind and helpless. His hearing coming back, he could hear their digital speech, high-speed bursts between them, low and sinister. They had him. The savage scout team had immobilized him with some kind of sensory scrambling explosive. And now they had him and were taking him to the coolers, the bubbles, where all the other survivors had ended up until it was their turn to become calories. He was crying, just like in the dream, sad that he'd never do another one, babe, for her ever again. Sad that he would never see her smile again. Sad that he'd somehow failed.
Chapter 65. Admiral Sulla was at the forward bridge of the Chang after leaving command of the Defiant to a subordinate officer. It was important for him to personally assume command of the assault frigate for the rescue effort, because Tyrus Rex was his responsibility and his oldest friend. He'd introduced him into the operation for better or for worse. That their little plan was going to be found out and that there would be serious repercussions with UW Navy was also a fact. There was a reckoning coming, and there was no denying that. And it was nearing go time for Chang's micro-jump back to the rendezvous with the trigger nuke team on New Vega. But Sulla had been an admiral for a long time, much longer than most suspected. And he'd made a lot of allies during that time. He knew a lot of secrets. He knew where the actual bodies were buried, so he had some cards to play. And if things didn't swing his way, well, then he could always start over. He had before. It's just that he'd never been so close to accomplishing the one way he sought to deal with the savage threat, as had been with the formation of the Coalition. He, like Rex, knew personally why the threat had to be dealt with before humanity could assume its place among the stars. The Coalition had been the first step toward a formal galactic government that oversaw the worlds and fielded a unified military capable of dealing with external threats. The savages were considered an external threat. They'd left humanity long ago. Hyperdrive connected humanity had more in common with the alien species they'd encountered via jumps through hyperspace than they had with their sociopathic ancestors crawling around at sublight speed between the worlds like ancient Viking invaders come to set some colony back for a few more hundred years of galactic dark age. In the day and a half since the assault frigate Chang had lifted off from the Stadium LZ as New Vega burned, and Coalition ground forces retreated en masse. Once the micro-jump back to the fleet had been completed, a massive rearmament program had taken place aboard the sturdy ship. All the missile stores the Chang could handle had been transferred from the rest of the surviving ships of Task Force Wrath. So had secondary shield generators from two other ships. Jury-rigged and patched into the defensive network, they were unreliable at best. But Sulla had thought it best to take everything he could to what was sure to be an all-out junkyard dogfight. They'd even transferred the one multi-warhead nuke the Defiant carried and set it up for a fast load off the cargo deck if they needed to fire it in anger. Using a ship-based multi-warhead nuke wasn't nearly as bad as lighting the fuse on a trigger nuke, but it wouldn't be pretty. Sulla finished briefing the Chang skeleton bridge crew he was carrying. Other than a full engineering complement to keep the power on and handle damage control, he'd transferred as many personnel off the assault frigate as he could before the rest of the fleet jumped out of the system. "Because you don't think you're going to make it out of this one?" he'd asked himself as he watched the quiet hum of activity that precipitated a ship getting underway for combat ops, or rather heard some voice asking him. After all, he had to admit to himself, one assault frigate against four savage hulks was hardly good odds on a great day with surprise in the mix. "No," he answered himself and slid behind the flight controls of the frigate. He didn't trust anyone to fly this one but himself, and the fewer people aboard, the fewer casualties they were going to take when they came out the other side of what was about to happen. And they were going to take casualties, that was for sure, even if not coming out the other side wasn't.
"Jump plot locked in," he asked the captain, who was now flying left seat on the frigate.
"Locked in green across the board, standing by to jump at your command, sir."
Sulla finished strapping in and donned his flight helmet, then he moved his chair forward and took the stick.
"I have the stick," he said, formally announcing that he was in command of flight for the Chang. "Sound the bells for battle stations. Give me engines to max. Executing jump in 5, 4, 3, 2.
Chapter 66. The savages were pursuing the APC into the tunnels as if they were some hive mind that had only just now reacted to the imminent threat within the vastness of the underground complex. As the APC powered through the midnight dark, two armored mechs moved fast on articulating walkers to cut off the vehicle before it could reach the lift down to level 22. Both savage war machines were spooling out heavy doses of lead ammunition. Rex directed a burst of aimed pulse fire from the APC's guns into one of the mech's insectile pilot's canopies and smashed glass and melted internal systems. A second later, Davis clipped the other mech's extending walker at high speed, shearing it off and collapsing the mech. The collision caused Davis to lose control of the APC. It spun off, slammed into a wall, and fishtailed before she finally regained control, and they were racing through the dark once more.
"Sure you can find that lift without the battle board?" Rex called.
"I drew the map, didn't I?" Rex didn't answer. He didn't like sarcasm when it wasn't coming from him. "The lift should be close now," offered Davis. The emergency lighting within the APC flickered on and off. Its power system had been damaged by the concussive impact of the two mechs' heavy weapons fire. In its flickering flashes, Rex got glimpses of the two little girls staring at him, one radiating cold anger, the other uncertain fear. Both were a kind of indictment against him that for some reason he couldn't shake off. "Hang on," shouted Davis over the comm. "Lift's not here." All four balls of the vehicle locked and extended their braking treads, and the vehicle skidded toward the yawning well where the lift should have been. With just meters to spare, they came to a halt. Rex popped the main hatch. His helmet's audio picked up the distant sound of more savage cycle teams inbound on their location. The awesome well that descended into darkness also rose up toward the smashed and ruined surface, from which distant shards of waning daylight fell down and died in the gloom. He scanned the utilitarian maintenance areas and cargo offloading decks that surrounded the well. All of the blisters, pipes, and bulges conspired to look like the bizarre hieroglyphics of some lost alien civilization.
"There's a smaller lift over there," he said over the comm. "You're 9 o'clock, Davis. Does it go down to the same place?"
"Only one way to find out." Rex vaulted from the vehicle and Davis followed, letting the low growl of the engines pull the APC forward. Reaching the lift control, Rex flipped open the safety cover and accessed the gate. Then he slammed his gauntleted fist onto the lift call button. The platform was currently 3 levels below. Seconds later, the first of 4 speeding savage cycles tore into the empty area of the well. He drew his hand cannon and engaged, dropping the weaving riders as they tried to rake him with strafing fire in their quick passes. "Radar reads more contacts coming in from multiple directions," Davis said. Her voice was controlled, but Rex could tell the veteran starship captain was nearing some limit. And so was he. Bullets smacked into the gate, and one nailed him solidly on his left arm. It was like being hit by a rocket-fired hammer, even with the armor he wore. He stumbled for the cover of the APC. The armor ran a diagnostic medical check and indicated a possible fracture. Armor integrity tightened up the area to immobilize the brake and still allow some mobility. Then it hit the screaming nerve endings with some anesthesia and calming drugs.
"You all right?"
asked Davis. She'd been watching him on the driver's screens. She'd seen him take fire and move for cover. He shot her a thumbs up in the cam feed, threw his back against the APC, and fired at another passing savage, dropping the rider and sending his bike skidding off the lip of the well and down into the distant darkness below. The platform had almost arrived when two savages activated their high beams and swooped in head-on at him, intent on running him down. The histrionic blare of their mounted submachine guns crackled to life. The liftgate was down and the platform arrived on their level.
"Move!"
shouted Rex. And then he took two steps toward the bikers and hit the armor's jets, vaulting above them in a sudden flare of energy-assisted lift. He was hoping to draw their attention off the broadside of the APC, whose armor seemed on the verge of giving up all integrity. If even one round breached the hull, it would ricochet around inside and eventually hit Davis or the girls. Davis drove the APC onto the lift platform as Rex pivoted in midair and followed the targeting tags on the two bikers. Two shots, high-powered 50-caliber depleted uranium slugs. Both bikes kept moving, their riders most likely dead or at least dying. They, too, shot off the lip of the central well and were swallowed by the darkness. And then Rex had his boots on the ground and was sprinting for the lift. Savage ground troops were flooding the chamber from access hatches and maintenance tunnels. A heavy weapons team opened up, attempting to range him as he crossed the distance. Rex closed the gate and sent the APC down to the complex's deepest level. Chapter 67.
"Run!"
shouted Martin, his voice hoarse, his breathing ragged. He'd grabbed the dying Sergeant Major from McAfee and the two survivors who'd been carrying the wounded man. All three looked out of even the energy to move themselves to safety.
"Back out," shouted Greenhill over the comm, and then announced, "Last one."
With the limp Sergeant Major dangling from his shoulders, Martin turned and sprayed the shadows behind with his pulse rifle, buying time for Greenhill to get his last charge pack loaded into the heavy. The savages returned fire, but it was wild and erratic.
"We're going to die here, Specialist," murmured the Sergeant Major. His eyes were closed and his blood was soaking Martin's back and shoulders. "Last pack now. We're down to knives and insults."
The old NCO thought that was funny and laughed, but it sounded like a death rattle.
"Keep running,"
shouted Martin at the survivors.
"Only darkness lay ahead. And the civilians didn't seem too keen to disappear into that all on their own, without weapons. But their pursuers were surging from the rear, and neither Greenhill nor Martin could be spared to take point. And now both soldiers were low on charge packs."
"Put me down, Specialist,"
coughed the Sergeant Major.
"This here, good as any place to die."
"Negative, Sergeant Major. We're going to make it."
Martin hustled up the tunnel as Greenhill laid down more fire from the heavy he carried. At least they still had sidearms, and after that, combat knives.
"Ain't over yet, Specialist."
"I like that,"
coughed the Sergeant Major. Martin could feel the man shaking on his back. Behind him, the Cav Sergeant's heavy pulse rifle suddenly went wild and cacophonic, like he was firing without pause at everything in every direction, and then it went silent. Its missing strobe-like flash plunged the tunnel into complete darkness. Greenhill was down for sure.
"Keep moving,"
Martin told himself, not really thinking about the odds or the situation, just thinking 10 steps more at a time, and then if he made that, maybe another 10. Life was down to just 10 steps. "Imagine that," said some distant part of his mind. And then he pushed that thought away and hustled on because he didn't need that right now. It didn't do him any good here at this last of moments. He understood that now he'd passed some limit and payday was coming due.
"Can't shoot for..."
grunted Greenhill, and then one of the savages kicked him in the gut with an armored combat boot, driving the air out of him. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw one of them drag his heavy away from the circle of punishment that was forming all about him, all of them chittering in their insane high-pitched digital eruptions. A circle of punishment, or a circle of death, because that was the way it looked right now. Another boot connected with his head. Stars and light erupted across his skull. This must be like what it feels like to get a pulse rifle shot right in the head, he thought distantly. When you got double tapped, and then another in the head, the last one, dull and distant. Well, he'd done that enough on Kimshana to others, that was for sure. So maybe his turn had just come up. Then the gloved iron fists were raining down on him, kicks too, beating him like he was a piece of meat. They're just tenderizing the meat, another part of him thought from far away. He tried to shout at them, to call them what they were, not just savages, but cannibals, the opposite of human, animals. But nothing came out, because his jaw had been broken. He tried to call them that all the same, because he was down to just insults now. Knives and... no. Sidearms and... And he was aware in that moment that he was certainly going to die in the next. He reached for his pistol. It was supposed to be on his thigh, and he hadn't felt them pull it off. Maybe they didn't know, or didn't understand sidearms, or really anything that used to be human and the way humans did things. These savages were a little better than animals now. So maybe there was a chance he could pull it and go to Fiddler's Green, just like the old calf poem that was part of every unit since. Another mailed fist hit him in the back, driving him to the dusty concrete of the rail tunnel floor. Put your pistol to your lips and go. It was there. His sidearm was there. His hand was broken, but he never no-minded the pain and got it out of its holster. In one last act of defiance, as the savage marine stepped away from him, laughing histrionically like digitized demons in some dance party song, he got on his knees and pulled the sidearm, his arm making it go wild as he tried to get it to his lips. And then a distant cannon was roaring, blazing away with angelic fury, like some summer storm in the morning on the highlands of the Kimshana Mountains, when everything was gold and silver and diffused light, terrible and beautiful, all at once, like that. He remembered those days on that hard world. The savages were dying in sudden explosive sprays or scrambling away only to be torn apart by sharp barks of automatic gunfire up close and far too personal. Maybe I'm next, thought Greenhill, and he didn't mind too much. He'd done his best to see it through, but your best didn't always mean it was enough. His mama had tried to tell him that when she'd tried to teach him religion. And then he fell over and passed in unconsciousness for at least 30 seconds. When he came to, Tyrus Rex was dragging him into the APC. And Sergeant Greenhill wondered if he might just live a few minutes longer. Chapter 68. There was no argument about what would happen next. Survivors were quickly loaded into the heavily damaged and shot to hell APC, occupying a space that had belonged to a trigger nuke that would end everyone else they ever hoped could still be alive in short order. It was still going to be a tight fit. Both Greenhill and the Sergeant Major were no longer combat effective, and truth be told, the Sergeant Major was in far worse shape than that. There were meds and a stabilization kit on board, but it didn't look good for the senior NCO. As Davis supervised the loading of the civilians, the ragged and desperate survivors squeezing in next to the two twin girls in the troop compartment, McAfee took Rex aside. Martin was on rear guard, waiting for more savage assets to catch up, waiting for them to appear out of the darkness and come swarming in for the attack. For now, things were awfully quiet. But rather than soothing everyone, the absence of battle rattle, incoming fire, return fire, and swarming and chittering savages seemed to put everyone on edge and even more ill at ease. The silence was more ominous than the battles that had been fought, if such a thing was possible.
"Hiya there, Tyrus, old buddy,"
said the scrappy artillery private. He spoke to the galaxy's most wanted war criminal with a familiarity that hadn't been established by any prior conversation Rex could remember having with the man.
"Heads up, but Wild Man is still active. He's still out there. He's alive, is what I'm trying to say."
Rex turned his head, but his emotions were hidden behind his battered and battle-scratched helmet.
"Yeah,"
continued McAfee, running his grimy hand through a dirty blonde shock of barely military-cut hair.
"He had a comm device on him, and I folded it into our net when we joined up. Comm also came with a locator and vitals authenticator, so it must have been military, not civilian. Anyway, I just checked to see if he was still alive, and he is, but his vitals are low."
The scrawny man didn't wait for Rex to get a word in. He just kept talking.
"He was in one place for a while just after we split up and them cycle teams was after us. Then he was on the move to sublevel 8. And that's where he is now."
Captain Davis had finished loading the APC and was now hovering over their conversation.
"There's no time, Tyrus," she said almost immediately. "We're less than 2 hours from the Chang's dust-off back at the LZ, not to mention the weapon you've set to detonate moments after departure. I'm sorry, but..."
She looked away suddenly, realizing what she was saying.
"It's a hard choice, I get that," she continued. "But we have to leave him behind. There's not enough time."
Rex could tell that half of her was hoping he'd remote disarm the nuke to give them more time, but that wasn't going to happen, not at all.
"I'll get him," said Rex. "Get these people to the dust off. If we're not there before departure, then tell Sulla it's gears up an emergency takeoff, because that weapon will go off at 1800 local.
"Hold on a minute, Tyrus," said Captain Davis, putting up one knife-edged hand. "Just hold on a minute, I'm telling you right now. I've lived down in these tunnels for 6 weeks.
She bent over and studied the map on McAfee's battle board. She pointed a finger at a blip that identified Wild Man's locator transponder. McAfee had even changed the tag inside the comm roster to read Wild Man.
"And you will not make it up to that level and back to the LZ in time," she continued. "No way. No how. I guarantee it, Tyrus. It cannot be done, and you will die down here."
"Feed me his loc and identify his signature so I can track him," said Rex to McAfee, ignoring the protestations of the captain.
"You got it.
Want me to go with?"
asked the private with a maniacal grin that indicated he was up for just about anything.
"Negative. Captain Davis needs you and Martin to get these people off planet. Make it happen."
McAfee saluted badly and scrambled into the APC. Maybe he hadn't been as up for going back into the Nightmare Tunnel network as his initial enthusiasm had suggested. Getting out had seemed impossible at various points during this little jaunt into the Savage Stronghold. Now, there was the real possibility that they might make it, and that was not a chance to be thrown away lightly. But Rex had always resolved himself to expect a one-way mission. That was his way, every time. That way, you played your hardest to be wrong about the outcome. Because if you were already dead, then what did you have to lose? Captain Davis stepped close and stared into the face of Rex's soulless helmet.
"Clarify something for me, please, because I don't understand this. You've accomplished your mission. The weapon is armed and will go off at just a few minutes after 1800 local. Job done. The entire remaining population, captured or not, hiding out somewhere in the hills or whatever, is going to die when this planet starts to cook. And that's fine by you. And now, with a straight shot, to get to an inbound ship that's got a chance of getting us off this doomed rock, you're going back for just one man."
Rex had grabbed a tactical ruck from the loadout and was busy stuffing it full of spare charge packs for the heavy, plus all the remaining fraggers.
"Yeah,"
he said as he closed the ruck and strapped it on.
"That's about it."
"That makes no sense, Tyrus. Not in any equation in this whole messed up mess does that make even the slightest bit of sense. Then why not shut down the timer on the trigger nuke and just save everyone?"
"Can't."
Why?
Because they're already dead. The savages will either turn them into resources or they'll turn them into more of themselves. This planet was dead. The moment those savages sat down, I've seen it too many times for it to be any other way, Captain. I can't save them.
So you'll just let them all die? She practically shrieked. No, that's not even right. You'll actually be the one killing them, because that's your device that's about to do all the dirty work. It'll be you who does them, Tyrus Rex, just like every other world you've tried to save.
She looked up and dropped her head back down, shaking it with her hands gripping her hips.
What a colossal joke, both it and you.
She slammed her palm into the side of the APC as though she were finished. But she wasn't. She was just opening her mouth to say more when Rex spoke again, getting right in her face.
Or maybe I'm trying to spare them from a living nightmare that might last for hundreds, if not thousands of years. Or, since these here on New Vega have gone cannibal, which is a new low I've never encountered before, some of these survivors might wake up out of one of those frozen bubbles to be next week's Sunday dinner. No, I don't think so, Captain. What I'm doing may make me look like a monster to you and all the rest of the galaxy who want to always choose the path of least resistance, but I don't care what all of you think. I never did. You and the rest get to have your pretty starships and snow globe civilizations because there are men and women, frankly, who are willing to do the hard things that need to be done when that's the only way forward. We slaughter the cattle so you can eat steak. Spare me your moralizing, and I'll spell it out for you so you get it in your head. And maybe if I don't make it back after you've learned your lesson, watching planet after planet get annihilated by these monsters, you'll get it and figure out what needs to be done. Here it is. There can't be two of us. It's either a galaxy full of savages or we humans get a chance, but we cannot coexist. It's us or them, because, according to them, we have to be eliminated for them to go forward. We're the part of the gene tree that didn't make the evolutionary cut, as far as they're concerned. We're the Cro-Mags, the Dodo. Their first mission is to destroy us or turn us into them. Both options have about the same mortality rate. Trust me on that one. They want us dead. The quicker people getting around to believing an enemy that tells you time and time again that it wants you dead, the faster something can be done about it in which you don't end up dead.
Through it all, Davis just stood there, arms crossed, eyes smoldering. And for a moment, Rex wondered why he was doing it again, why it was suddenly so damn important to make her understand his point of view. It didn't matter. She wasn't going to stop him. And yet he went on, more worked up than he could remember in a long, long time.
And us, we have to, repeat, have to, clear them before we can find out what's out there. We can't have these monsters they've made themselves into constantly tearing down everything we've built the farther out we expand. New Vega's dead. This is all we could save, he said, waving one gauntlet at the APC and everyone within. This, and one more. I'm going to go get the last one.
She tilted her head after he finished, looking in no way convinced.
Why?
Rex stared at her from behind his helmet for a long moment, saying nothing. He clenched his fists.
Because he said he would follow me, for that reason and that reason alone. In that, including you, we all became brothers. If just for now, if just for this battle, you fight together, you survive together. We're something more than just the rest of the population. We're family now. And to the best of my ability, if there's a chance, I'll bring my brother back alive. I have to take that chance. I wouldn't be me if I didn't.
Tyrus Rex.
She said his name like it was a dirty word.
Yeah, replied Rex dismissively. Whoever that is.
She stared at him hard, just like the twin girls.
I'm going now,
he said in the silence that followed.
Listen to me and get off this planet, Captain.
And then he was gone, down tunnel, trotting off into the darkness with several kilometers to cross. His pace looked too slow for the 2 hours that remained of the planet's life. Too slow if he was going to accomplish what he'd set out to accomplish. Not enough in a time when so much would be required to merely go on drawing breath. But there are some who run toward the fire, despite the odds. She knew that much as she watched him disappear into the tunnel dark.
Chapter 69. There were abandoned scout cycles all along the way. Most had been destroyed, either exploding against a tunnel wall or riddled so badly with pulse fire that they were now inoperable. But eventually Rex found one still in working order, its rider shot down by one of his volunteers from Strike Team Ranger, and he got it started. Inside his HUD, he had a good tag on the strange and enigmatic sniper that had just folded himself into their little ad hoc fellowship with barely a word, and he'd been one of the best snipers that Tyrus had ever fought alongside. That some horrific tragedy had befallen him prior to the battle was evident. That he'd once been a soldier was evident, too. That he'd been horribly wounded was plain to see by anyone with functioning eyes. Rex had met many such men in his travels across the stars. But this wild man, like all of them, had agreed to see it through no matter what, and Rex had promised to do his best to get them all back. He owed them that. Now it was time to honor his end of the commitment. No one gets left behind. He set out along the tunnel riding fast. He was carrying Green Hill's heavy along with his own hand cannon. He killed the high beam and relied on his helmet's IR, low imaging overlays, along with the bare emergency lighting, to see his way forward as he thundered along. And what he saw was a swarm of cycles approaching fast, with something bigger behind their speeding cluster, a mech even larger than the two they'd collided with in the APC. In fact, it was barely able to fit inside the tunnel. Rex met the oncoming cycles like a comet, headed into an asteroid field. Whether the approaching Savage Scout Marine riders thought he was one of their own, a survivor with a malfunctioning comm returning with intel, or another Savage unit from a different vessel, was unclear. But the riders parted to make way, and he shot through their midst and underneath the massive legs and gears of the following walker. Only at the last second did they realize he wasn't a friendly. Rex knew more about the Savages than any living soul, even more than Sulla. And as frightening as this new alliance of Savages from different hulks was, he knew the chances were good that there was some miscommunication going on between them. The various sides might not yet be married up and cohesive, everyone using the same playbook, the same codes and phrases. The arrogant nature of the average Savage culture was probably still on full xenophobic overdrive against any other culture, even other Savage cultures, that didn't think exactly like they did. There was even a decent chance they'd start fighting one another again soon. As some old politician had once suggested, maybe the answer is to have two enemies so that they would kill each other. But right now, that was probably too much to ask for. His armor's local radar showed that some of the Savage scouts had broken off from their pack and were heading back after him. Seconds later, incoming rounds were streaking across his HUD. The armor kicked in, computing bullet fire trajectories and anticipated cones of engagement. He had a good head start. They wouldn't catch him unless they were packing something bigger in the engine department. The rest of the Savages continued on, no doubt in pursuit of the APC. But as long as the armored vehicle's engines held, it would make it to the LZ. And then they'd be safe. Unless the Savages were planning on mounting another assault. And Rex thought that unlikely. Despite their reinforcements, the Savages had taken a beating just as badly as the Coalition forces had. It would take time for them to regroup. Which meant this was the exploitable moment for Rex and the others. Move about in the confusion between xenophobic cultures and try to get off planet before the trigger nuke detonated and cooked off every hydrogen molecule it could chain react with. He'd seen a trigger nuke crack a planet's core before. It was horrible. Ahead, Rex saw the wan half-light over a terminal platform.
There was no way to get the bike up on the platform, at least not quickly enough to stay ahead of his pursuers. So he ditched it and ran for an escalator, dragging the heavy from around his back and looking for a good ambush site. He found one at the top of the escalator with a good field of fire on the platform below. Unlike Rex, the pursuing savages did take the time to stop their bikes and drag them up onto the platform. A mistake. When they were all in view, some gunning their engines while others worked their bikes up off the tracks, Rex opened up with the heavy. They were grouped together tightly. Whether they had no real military training or had merely gotten lazy after driving the coalition off planet, he couldn't say, but it was bad soldiering and they paid the price. Heavy pulse fire on high cycle automatics spat out hundreds of shots. A normal squad heavy gunner would have had a hard time stabilizing weapon crawl on high cycle automatic fire. The powerful rifle tended to jump and squirm at the blur of heavy automatic fire spraying from the barrel. But the armor's cybernetic stabilization system, coupled with the advanced targeting in Rex HUD, stabilized the heavy and kept it on target, working the tangos until they were good and down. All dead in 15 seconds. Rex stood from his concealed position at the top of the escalators and swapped in a new charge pack, letting the old one clatter to the floor. Smoke rose from the barrel of the heavy pulse gun. Then he turned and set off through the field of dead savages his team had shot during their flight not long before. Chapter 70. Wherever Rex went, there were more dead savages, both the hunters and the cannibal marines with the dull-finished mirrored helmets. Martin, Greenhill, and Andres had made the savages pay all along the way. Mixed in was the occasional human, one of the New Vegan citizens who'd gotten hit in the crossfire. But there were many more dead savages. There was no sense in picking up the wild man's back trail. Rex had a clear ping on his current location, and he had a pretty good idea what the savages had in mind for the big sniper. Storage. He found a small passenger elevator away from the big central transportation disk. Using the big lift would probably bring him into contact with more savage elements. This smaller one didn't go up as high as he needed to go to reach the wild man, but it was close enough, and more importantly, less deadly. He leaned back against the hardwire mesh of the small cage as he passed several unlit levels. He was tired, and any bit of rest, what he could get of it, was welcome. Some part of his mind asked him how much more he had left. He ignored it, as he always did. The moment you decided how far you'd go, that was exactly how far you would go. Too bad if you needed to go farther. Tyrus Rex wasn't a thinker, never had been, or at least no one would have ever accused him of such. He seemed a man of constant action and determined purpose. But the galaxy was vast, and there had been many hours, days, accumulated years in hyperspace to just sit and merely think. And because he'd lived longer than most, and was quite unsure exactly how long he had yet to live, thanks to the savage experiments aboard the Obsidia, everyone he'd ever known, everyone he ever would know as the years progressed, had died or would die long before he did. And so he spent a lot of time thinking things forward, never looking back unless he was tactically assessing some situation from the past with the intent of figuring out some problem of the present or the impending future. Right now, he was thinking about Captain Davis and her hard words, and Sulla, who'd said pretty much all the same things to him over the years about finally getting humanity together to deal with the savage problem instead of emulating Tyrus Rex and employing the most extreme of measures. But it took extreme measures, because when you thought it all the way forward, that was all that one man could do. He couldn't fight a battle on his own, but he could wage a one-man war and trigger nukes even the playing field when it was won against upwards of 40,000 combat troops at a go, not to mention all the high-tech surprises the savages brought to the battlefield, always an unknown variable. Not even Tyrus Rex could beat those odds. No soldier could. It would take an army, a collection of warriors with a unity of purpose, and in lieu of that, trigger nukes. They were a necessity, so he had said many times, and he had been right. They were a necessity, because he'd been fighting alone,
forced to wage the war that no one else would, forced there by the indifference, unwillingness, or short-sightedness of others, one soldier against 1,000 armies. "You're not a soldier anymore," he told himself. At first he wanted to say it was Sulla's voice that had stung him, reminding him that he was no longer what he'd once thought only of. It might have even been the voice of the pretty yet austere starship captain, telling him that he hadn't been a soldier for a long time. But in the end, as the lift slowly crawled up through the half-lit shadows, he had to admit it was his own voice. His own voice telling him the truth. "You're not a soldier anymore," he whispered. "You're just an assassin." The small ramshackle cage shuddered to a halt and the security gate swung open. As Tyrus Rex stepped out into the darkness of a multi-level warehouse, IR signatures flared to life in his hood. There were hundreds of savages waiting here in ambush, as though they'd known he'd come this way all along. Chapter 71. The Chang came in hot through Nevega's atmosphere. She was burning up O2 through re-entry effect when they fell out of micro-jump at almost full cruising speed. The ship's captain, who was now acting as co-pilot to Admiral Sulla, called out the bow angle and altitude. Overspeed indicators moved to alarm, direly warning of impending impact with the ground below. Sulla, who had his hand on the throttle, pulled back all four levers connecting to the main four engines. "Bring in inertial reversers," he commanded. For the first few seconds, flying re-entry was all the crew could do. Micro-jumps with a destination exit inside an atmosphere were the trickiest of feats to pull off when it came to jump navigation. It took everything you had and a little bit of blind luck not to leave a crater in some world's face. The ship was shaking violently, and automated damage control reports flared across the digital HUD along the forward window of the cockpit. Radar and sensors called out from the CIC at the rear of Chang's bridge. "Contact. We got a hulk in the air, Admiral."
"Find the LZ," ordered Sulla.
He sat up in his chair, straining to see the ground over the controls and instruments in front of him. Atmosphere howled and whistled beyond the fuselage.
"Multiple lock-ons detected," shouted another tech from back in CIC.
"I have it," said the Chang's captain from the co-pilot seat. "Hour 2 o'clock.
Sulla spotted it and heeled the ship over to pick up the course track.
"PDC's warming up," announced the weapons officer prophetically, while at the same moment the radar and sensor tech shouted that the Savage Hulk had sent missiles incoming.
A moment later, the belch of the Chang's PDCs erupted across the hull as the defensive weapons system tried to fill the air between the ship and the incoming missiles with hundreds of thousands of tiny projectiles. Any hit would detonate a ship's missile.
"Multiple splashes," called out a tech operating the PDC assessment grid, indicating the weapons were doing their job of keeping the incoming missiles at bay.
"Hulk leaving the battle space," cried out the navigation officer. "Their intercept was all wrong."
"There's a break," thought Sulla. He flew the course toward the LZ, dropping the ship down through the billowing black smoke and the scud of atmospheric layers.
"We got lucky," said the captain and laughed nervously.
Sulla's eyes went wide as right behind the man, out the co-pilot's window, savage interceptors swooped out of the smoke-filled afternoon. Hot, bright lines of incoming fire raked the Chang's hull with just 3 kilometers to the LZ.
"Weapons hot on all turrets," announced the CIC's tactical officer. "Engaging."
Chapter 72. There was no retreat, no safe place to fall back to. Tyrus Rex knew the only way through was through. He bumped his jets in the instant before the savages began to fire at him, crossing the floor to a pyramid of stacked supply freight containers, each the size of a rail car. That quick movement instantly denied a firing solution to at least 75% of the savages involved in the ambush, or so Rex's helmet told him. His back pinned to a container, Rex raised the heavy rifle and cut loose with a blur of fire on a team of savages to his right. Within seconds, he'd pulse them to shreds. But the savages were reacting quickly. They swarmed the container from all sides to get at the crevice he'd found. He shot 3 with quick bursts, and bumped his jets once to hit the next level as he let the heavy dangle from its sling.
He'd used those jump jets a lot. Like the defense bubble, they couldn't go on forever without a recharge, and neither could he. He popped a fragger and dropped it where he'd been, then ran along the side of the container. Farther back and higher up in the darkened warehouse, the savage version of squad-designated marksmen had taken up support positions for the close infantry assault teams. Now these snipers fired crack shots from old-school weapon systems that reminded Rex of the ancient Barrett rifle of his earliest days. Any one of those rounds would do a serious number on his armor and the body beneath. That was the thing about the savages. It was their anachronistic tech in this bright, brilliant modern age of the galaxy, an age of energy-efficient blasters and older model pulse rifles, that made them so vicious. Old-school chemical firearms were still the most violent thing the galaxy could produce. They went beyond simply killing, like a blaster or pulse rifle, and inflicted maximum damage. Huge holes appeared in the cargo container Rex ran along as the snipers sent down shots from the upper reaches of the warehouse. Rex popped more grenades, bumped his jets, and tried to stay a moving target. There was neither room nor time to bring the heavy into play.
Explosions ripped through the warehouse as his grenades detonated. Small sprays of shredded metal were turned into projectiles with their own terminal velocity as savages were ripped apart. All was chaos and madness within the subterranean cave of the storage facility. Rex hunkered low, raised the heavy, and sprayed the area where a sniper was shooting from. Vicious pulse fire ripped through the atmosphere of the warehouse and the savage working the old Barrett-like rifle. Charge pack out, Rex swapped in a new one and shifted position. A squad of savages tried to block his escape route, but he was guns up on them as they almost collided into one another in the tight quarters. At point-blank range, he dumped the whole charge pack on high-cycle fire and ventilated the entire squad because there was no room in all the chaos for precision or economy. There was no room for anything but extreme violence. Just how you like it, Tyrus. He wasn't sure whose voice that was, but it was right. Another charge pack out, and Rex had no time to swap in a new one before an additional team came at him from another quarter, honing in on the carnage of the seconds before. He pulled the hand cannon and auto-fired it into the surging mass. Heavy-caliber slugs tore through the savage's armor. Rex's 50-caliber rounds disintegrated systems and brains, sending misty metallic sprays from the helmets of the savage marines and the skulls of the Morlock attackers. Their demise was brutal and without mercy, if only because there was no other way. For a moment, Rex caught a break, but not enough of one to load in a new charge pack. The armor was picking up the sound of more boots and creating an overlay of where everyone might be in the battle space, which was, to put it simply, everywhere. His only way out was straight up. He chain-ripped a bandeau of fraggers and left them right where he'd been as he rocketed skyward with what remained of his jump juice, and there was precious little of it left. The swift jump brought him to the top of the pyramid stack of containers, just as the bandeau exploded, devastating the two swarms of savage infantry who'd tried to close in on his last known position in a coordinated effort. From up here, he could get a better look at the squad-designated marksman teams. The armor tagged them, and Rex burned the last of his jump juice to reach a crane balcony where a team was operating. Hand cannon ready. He started putting rounds into snipers up here in the heights. They couldn't react fast enough to his sudden proximity and died on their bellies. Moving along the gantry beneath the ceiling of the warehouse, taking badly aimed fire from scrambling sniper teams at the far end,